Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to a new episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett. Today, we have a super awesome episode. We have one of our guests back for a second time, so this is a landmark. We have Michael Horn back with us. He is, you may remember him from a few weeks ago talking about cool stuff, mainly around education and lots of cool stuff. He is an author and a speaker. And yeah, we're going to continue our conversation from last time. So thank you so much for coming back with us, Michael. I really enjoyed the last conversation. That was, I always feel like I learn a lot in these, but talking with you last time, I felt like I learned more than usual.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm just glad I didn't say anything that got me barred from the show. So it's good to be with you guys.
No, no, that would be very hard to do.
Michael, welcome back. We are so glad you're here. And for continuity, please tell us a little bit about your work you're doing right now, please. Just say a little bit about, you know, the work you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a senior strategist at Guild Education, where I'm spending most of my time these days. Guild, for those that don't know, partners with large companies to basically fuel their education benefit programs to be able to serve largely their frontline workforce to help them attract better talent, retain that talent, upskill them for the jobs of the future, which are not so futuristic anymore because coming out of the pandemic, we've seen a lot of automation of roles. And so you really need to upskill your talent so that they can work with the technology, but also because otherwise those jobs in many cases are going away right now. And so Guild basically helps connect employees to a marketplace of learning options and then pairs that with coaching to make sure that those students get the support that they need to be successful. So that's where I spend most of my time. And then I continue, obviously, as you know, to do my writing and podcasting and speaking on both K-12 and higher education.
Thank you so much for that, Michael. So I want to pick up from where we left off last time. And I just want to start by asking you. So when we think of education, if you look back, you know, maybe 100 or so years ago, it was considered a noble enterprise. It was the ivory tower, you know, you get to be educated and then you can make a difference in the world. And we see education as this value add for our community as a whole. Does education, whether it's elementary or post-secondary or higher ed, does it still maintain that same level of nobility and value to the planet?
That's a good question. I think the answer is education writ large, right, still has that connotation. I think we are seeing a souring or suspicion, perhaps, of the institutions themselves that provide that. And what I mean by that is there's no question, you know, you come in with a PhD or a master's, like that signal still stands for something. We know that having a bachelor's degree, for example, on average has its challenges. We can get into that later, but, is going to significantly boost your earnings, your ability to contribute into your community in some significant ways. So I think the answer is yes on that hand. And it's also true that the public writ large starting to ask some serious questions about higher ed institutions, right? The ones that have been out there and they're on a range of dimension. They're asking about value. Do they really connect you to the right employers? Do they cost too much? Are there alternatives to getting education? So I think education is still valued. And frankly, we need it more than ever right now, given, you know, what we just talked about technological automation and so forth. And just the rapidly shrinking shelf life of skills. We need more learning in education, but I think there's a healthy dose of, or sometimes unhealthy dose, I suppose, of skepticism around the institutions themselves.
Absolutely. And so there has been a lot of digs at education, specifically higher education. And I would say even so at elementary schools of more digital or online education. I remember maybe 5 or 6 years ago when we started hearing these commercials of kids talking about they can go to college in their pajamas. You know, they don't have to fight for a parking space and all those things. And I think that was really a frontal attack on traditional higher education, because higher education has almost always been focused on seats and chairs, right? So brick and mortar education. So COVID gave us a whole new experience about that, right? So what we had held on to for so many years as the way you're supposed to educate people really had to change, because we were, you know, sheltered in place. This pandemic was wreaking havoc on our health. So we on this place. Do you think we will ever go back to a time where seats and chairs or face-to-face instructions in brick and mortar will become the dominant way to learn again, where it will supersede this online education march?
It's a great question. I think what you might see is healthier combinations of the two in the future. And what I mean by that is you can learn the content online, right? Anywhere. But there probably will still be convening places in brick and mortar locations where you're working on a project with others, where you're doing some experiential opportunities, where you're working with your mentor, where you are gathered with a community of people that have similar goals that you're working toward, right? And I think the future is likely to look more bricks and clicks than just either one alone, if you will. And the way I think about it, though, is, to your point, is I think it's less likely that the brick and mortar institutions, so like they're like the Macy's, the large department stores, right? And they add a website, Macy's.com. That's, you know, not the future of retail, right? And I don't think it's going to be the future of higher ed either, where, you know, the established large brick and mortar institution adds online. They'll certainly do that. It'll be, you know, help them a little bit. But I think more likely the future is, you know, Amazon, Warby Parker, Bonobos, where it's the online store that adds the brick and mortar experience. And they don't have the huge footprint and the massive thing, but it's about creating this really cool personalized experience for you as the individual. You go into, you know, Warby Parker, you get fitted, whatever else. And then like, voila, the next day somehow arrives, you know, six glasses that you can check out. Right. I think we'll see something similar in higher ed, where you have the Southern New Hampshire universities of the world or the Western Governors universities of the world. I suspect you'll start to see them put brick and mortar, you know, mini campuses or, you know, WeWork is now a dirty word, but partnerships with those sorts of things, right? To create these experiences that are very bespoke and supportive and perhaps situate alumni or students with the alums to connect you to social capital that is so important. And that's not to say online can't create social experiences or connect you to social capital. It clearly can. But I do think humans, as we've seen, like to be with each other in person also. There's something different about that. And I think facilitating that is probably, you know, where we're going in all this. I do think that there will remain a place for the brick and mortar, you know, experience. But I don't expect it to be the dominant one in, you know, a few decades from now.
I agree with you completely. And I think that one of the interesting pieces about this, I think I told you all this, I wrote my dissertation on online education completion, right? So, because I think your point of whether we like to see each other and be with each other affects completion. So if you were going for a 4-year degree and it's fully online, you know, and you don't get that experience of going on campus, going to a football game or going and hanging out with your friends or whatever, does that affect the value of the education? But to that point, you know, so pre-COVID, we had Coursera, edX, and a few other companies come out, and all, well, I shouldn't say all, many of the higher institutions partnered with them, and you could get courses to everybody else. So like it was a marketplace where you could convert students to your institution, or at least to something your institution is delivering, i.e. if I get an online degree from Duke, it means something. Okay, whatever. And then there were some faculty members that were doing more hybrid, right? So that flipped class thing. So like you go do all the work inside at home and you come into the building to have a conversation or discuss whatever it was that you learned. And so all of those models were on the table before COVID. But now that we have, you know, COVID and the concerns that still linger, and I'm guessing that there will be future COVIDs in the future. I don't think this is a one and done thing. I think that there'll be future iterations of things that shelter us again And I'm sure that people who are in charge, like yourself, Michael, are thinking about how to deal with these kinds of problems before we get hit with them, that you guys are preparing the world for how do we learn based on all of these things. But you and people like you do have a problem in that, does the infrastructure exist for models like hybrid or digital or whatever it is? So Biden has this bill where he wants to, you know, provide infrastructure to all the communities. But how do you and the people who think about this all the time think about the next COVID and what it may mean based on the models that we know that exist? So the Coursera's, the brick and mortar, the Zoom education model, which is my
Zoom
favorite.
Yeah.
Zoom University, right. So how do those things work? And as you're planning to think about the next pandemic or the next event that's triggered us to go offline, and I would even further extrapolate that to the next ransomware.
Yeah, well, so, and that's where I was going to go, actually. But let me, since you went there, I'll hold it for a moment. So three thoughts. One, I think what we've seen out of this pandemic, it started actually before the pandemic, but it's really emerged, is this new form of online learning, which is cohort-based courses. OutSchool, I think, was the pioneer of that in the K-12 setting, but now you have tons of these. And one of the founders of Udemy, Goggin, has his startup, and I'm blanking on the name right now, but there's all these cohort-based online courses, you know, small groups, right? Intimate settings in which you're learning. I do think that's like the disruptive wave to the Courseras of the world, if you will, because they can't possibly compete with that. It would screw up their model of one to, you know, millions, if you will.
Right.
I think that's going to be very interesting to watch that. And I think that'll be part of the answer, because it'll be more intimate community actually out of this, hopefully the next time, you know, God forbid. But I think you're probably right that that does occur. The second thought in terms of infrastructure, I would like to see more activity still in making sure everyone's got internet connectivity at home. I don't think we have seen the attention or marshaled the response yet that we need on that front. And we know it's disproportionately impacted low-income minority families, K-12, you know, significant swaths of students did not have connectivity at home. And I'll say my own view on this has evolved. My assumption from my disruptive innovation framework was like, well, technology is getting better. We're going to have a next wave of lower cost opportunities that will extend access. That's how it works. And I think that's true. And I also think like, it's really hard to participate in today's society if you don't have internet connectivity. And so we kind of got to think of it like infrastructure and solve the problem tomorrow. And we have the means to do it. Like, it's actually not that much money or technical know-how. You know more about this than I do, Rochelle. But I think we need to get way more urgent on that. And then the third thing is where you went on the ransomware, which is, you know, as university leaders and others are planning for what's next, what's the next, you know, COVID interruption or whatever else, technology was a lifesaver over the last 18 months. Like, I don't actually think for, you know, people like me who maybe bash certain experiences or others, we don't step back enough and say like, what a miracle the last 18 months was. Like, if this had happened 20 years ago, I mean,
what?
Like, society would have frozen, right? And so it's incredible that it happened when it did and we were able to marshal the response that we did. Now imagine that happens again and cybersecurity of some sort hits. And we bring down, I mean, it's not just like the Zoom bombing, we bring down whole universities and networks and institutions and so forth. Privacy data starts getting shared in really bad ways. I don't know that we are prepared for that. And I don't feel like I at least hear enough conversation of like, okay, this has to be where we start investing dollars. It's not in the brick and mortar facilities. It's going to be in cybersecurity, because that's the infrastructure that's really going to matter for our disaster preparedness next time around. And by the way, that means education also,
right,
of training, you know, tens of thousands more people to be able to equip all the different organizations, companies, institutions, et cetera, who provide this lifeblood, experiences to be able to keep them up and running and securely.
Absolutely. We still are just shocked about Zoom, because for the longest time, Cisco WebEx was the conference software that we used. And all of a sudden, a little small upstart Zoom comes along. And now Zooming has become a noun, a verb, an adverb, and a few other kind of words, you know, so we're absolutely right. But I want to ask you something. And so one of the things I have been, you know, troubled with, and that is my own community. So I'm a Black woman. I work in IT, but I'm more of an exception than a rule in terms of what I have been able to accomplish in many cases. But what has really been phenomenal to me is to look at the lack of understanding of minority communities, right? So, you know, this now has become the you don't know if you can see my phone, but this has become the computer for a lot of children, right? So I've got, and if the program or the website has not designed itself for mobile access, it doesn't look the same. And I'm now counting on Wi-Fi more than ever to do everything I can do. And so I have been thinking, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this and yours as well, Drew. It's like, I have been thinking, how do we put together a help desk for the world? And I know that's a really awful question, but you know, this goes back to that education piece, right? So if you're poor, you're in a rural community, whatever the impediment is, where do you go when you need an answer? So I can ask you, Drew, I need to know how to code an app that allow people to play chess. Who do I ask that question to? Who do I ask? I can ask Drew, because Drew is a technologist. He's smart. He understands a lot, but this might not be his answer. But imagine the poor woman in some rural part of North Carolina, Durham, where living in the projects, that have these questions. Every time I go to Zoom and I try to share my screen, the screen is black. I get that question a lot. So I just want to tell you, that's why I came up with it. But your screen, where do they go to get these answers? Where do they go to get help? So in addition to the digital divide, in addition to the poor infrastructure, especially in rural and poor areas, where are the solutions that help people who need it most under, you know, maybe difficult circumstances, if we can consider COVID difficult or ransomware difficult? Where do they go to get help and to be prepared to protect and to do whatever they need to do to continue to survive?
So I know, like, personally speaking, like when you say that, like, I think about, oh, write a chess app. Well, the first thing that I'm going to do is like Google it, and I'm going to go through the results. But, and like, I think you brought up like a good point, though, is like, even just Googling and searching for things is not as straightforward when you don't do it for a job all day long. Like, I've watched people who aren't as computer savvy, and it's like, oh, well, let's Google that real fast. And it's like, okay, well, you got the results. Don't click on that first one. That's an ad. Don't click on the second one. That's not what you want. You got to like scroll down. Oh, and also add this other term. And like, it's sort of, I think there's more of a, I don't know if it's an art or a skill to doing these sorts of searches when you're looking for something, to really like know how to talk to either the search engine or the computer to get, to tell it to give you what you want. And that's not, it takes practice and training, I think, is a,
yeah. And the other thing I guess I would add is that I have a couple thoughts. One, this is where I think social capital comes in again, and the networks you're a part of, right? I mean, I know we get half of our answers for our kids from Facebook groups that my wife is a part of. By the way, I'm not welcome to some of them, but she's in them. And so she says, oh, well, you know, clearly like these people have done hours and hours of research, so the answer for X is this, right? And then we go out and do that. The other thing, I think sometimes it's like Reddit or boards like that are part of the answer, but you have to know about those, right? And you have to have access to those. And then the third thought I had is actually, there's an interesting proposition I saw literally this week from a guy named Matt Haldeman, who's worked in the education sphere over many years, where he said, he started, I guess, a new education company. And he said the idea that they've come up with is creating a student help desk for high schools. So, you know, thinking that you're going to be able to pay and scale IT professionals at all these places in the numbers that we probably need, probably not going to happen. And so how do you create a set of student resources in the high school as in the community that are there to solve, troubleshoot, answer questions, et cetera. And I said, I think it's a brilliant idea. I don't know how you pay for it, but I think it's a brilliant idea to set up, you know, sort of the equivalent of the newspaper club. It's the 21st century equivalent, right, of that, or the yearbook or something like that. And so I wonder, those individuals then also might build something that is broader than the schools, as I'm playing it out, that becomes resources for the community itself. That could be pretty exciting, actually, when you play it forward. Last quick thought. I totally agree about the mobile platform idea, Rochelle, that you're raising. I think it's where the learning is going. I may have said this on the last time we were together, but, and this is like my disruptive brain of why I'm sort of like, well, let's not over-optimize for the laptop, because like mobile phone is, you know, significantly less money. It's going to be way more accessible to many more. And like, that's where the puck's going. And if we install base infrastructure on the laptop, then we like might crowd out the innovation we need on the mobile. So that's why I get always a little nervous about just like, we're going to fund everything, but you know, I think there's probably the Wi-Fi connectivity is something we ought to fund. But the mobile platform, I just think the most interesting education apps and tools right now are appearing when they're natively written for that platform, and they get rid of all the bells and whistles of the videos of Coursera that distract and things like that. And they're just like super active learning platforms, like Quantic MBA program. If someone wants to get an MBA and they're really interested in the learning, a little less like the, you know, Duke Fuqua experience, I would say Quantic MBA is the best program out there, bar none. It's just like really, it's just really good. Duolingo, if you want to learn the basics of a language, you eventually got to have conversations, but if you want to learn the basics, Duolingo is where I'd go, right? Or there's a couple others like it. And I get yelled at when I say Duolingo, but the point is that these natively mobile apps, I think, is where the future is going. Which is a good thing. It's going to be way more accessible, and I think will be instructionally more sound, actually, because it'll be a more active experience, because they're going to have to engage you to keep you on that screen from hopping to Instagram or TikTok or whatever else might be flashing notifications at you.
Absolutely. So I want to circle back to that, though. So remember, I'm talking about people that are not savvy in a lot of areas that would require them to participate there. So hypothetically, and I can tell you a gazillion real examples of this. I'm a poor Black family. I've got four kids. They're all in some level of school, public education. And I don't know, my child has come to me and said the Zoom background does not allow him or her to share the image. So more likely than not, that parent would then go to the teacher or the school and say, help me with this. And Drew and I can attest to this is actually fact. You know, we're almost always suspected that the product that you're using or the app is the problem, not anything we provided you. So if we've given you a Zoom application, it is not Zoom. There's something wrong with something you're doing. Now, yep. So you're the technician at the school system, and the person who said, "My I can't share my screen. Everything I share is Black." The technician is going to try to work through that problem, but the technician now has a whole group of people that they have to support. So one, the person who is at home or the parent or whoever it is needs to be educated in some way to understand how to do the basics of troubleshooting. So Drew's point of Googling it is really good, right? So if you type that in, Zooming Black background cashier, you'll get a gazillion answers to that. You know, there's a gazillion answers. And then Drew said correctly, you know, there's so much of that is spam and phishing and all kinds of stuff on top of that. You got to drill down far enough to get to the answer. Michael, what you said about your friend is exactly what I had in mind. You know, like, so smart cities, digital education, all of these things need a resource that educates its citizens, its communities, that provides a resource for help, and that continues to help advance what you understand even when you get. So i.e. you live in a rural area and there's very little internet connectivity there. So all you have is your phone and your Wi-Fi, if you can get that to work during that time. So is there a method where we think about how to address these complex problems across an entire spectrum? So not just, you know, Black and white, not young and old, not just, but like, where is my resource? And in my opinion, it's not going to a school to learn this, because I only need my answers to make me function in my society. So I don't need to understand cybersecurity to understand what ransomware is to function. I need to know what ransomware is so if I experience it. So where do I go to get these answers? Do you still believe firmly that it is in a traditional education model, whether that's brick and mortar or digital? Or is there something else similar to what you said your friend had in mind? Because I've been asking this question now for months. I haven't gotten anybody to answer it for me yet. For the everyday citizen to have a resource that they can go so they can report a problem, maybe get a solution, or to have help understanding what these technologies mean.
Yeah, so I don't know that there is a solution that exists today. I think it's ad hoc, right? It's the networks that you're involved with. It's the social networks that you are connected to. And we know that there's great disparity in that, and that's not a systematic solution of any sort. But I like your idea of how do we sort of, it doesn't have to be through the schools per se, it could be through other institutions in the communities. I mean, heck, it could be through churches, cities, like there's a variety of ways you could imagine scaling something like this where you could, I'm just thinking about the mechanism, you'd essentially have the community verify that someone is in fact an expert and can be part of the help desk. And so maybe in my church community or my rural town or whatever it is, we don't have someone that rises to that, but it's able to connect me to a string of other trusted, you know, if I'm Southern Baptist, another Southern Baptist church, right? So that there's a trust there that I'm getting someone that understands the context in which I'm asking the question as well.
That's very, very helpful. I want to give you one example of something that happened. So, I don't know if this happens in the private sector or not in higher ed, but you know, there are great spam and phishing attempts. You'll get an email from the president of the university asking you to come have coffee with him or her. Now, to date, the president has never reached out to you, never asked you for coffee. He doesn't even know who you are. He's sure you're one of his employees. If he were to see your name, but he doesn't know you. But you, yep, as a staff, a student, or a faculty gets this email. And in my mind, there ought to be a part of you that immediately starts questioning it. What?
Sure.
Totally. Why is the president inviting me to have coffee? But there are people who believe that that's a legitimate email and click on it or respond, yep, to it.
Yep.
The education of that does not exist anywhere that I can think in a traditional school. It says this is.
No, I agree. So there's actually a new book coming out that I just saw this morning. Richard Culotta, who's the head of ISTE, the International Society of Technology and Education, who is, I think the argument he's going to make, I haven't read the book yet, it comes out in a few weeks, is that rather than like all of the obsession from a fear-based way of how much screen time and stuff like that, let's like accept the reality that technology is a fundamental part of our lives and view it in a positive way of like, how do we educate about it and through it so that we can use it positively and not get ensnared by the negativity. And I think there's some of that in schools in like sort of the digital literacy curriculum, but probably not in any robust way, right?
I agree totally. So Drew, I want to ask you, so when you think about school, how old is your son?
He is 15. He is out like driving in driver's ed right now. So y'all like keep your fingers crossed.
Bless you.
Yeah. Have you paid your insurance premiums for this month?
Oh, those insurance premiums will be so high soon.
so as he's going through the traditional education system, what are the things that come to your mind as a parent that you wish you had known prior to him going through the school system?
So, I mean, it's so weird now with COVID, because his school for the past year has been like, he's been in school like upstairs, right? Like right above us. And they're in school on, I don't think they use Zoom. I think they use like Google Classrooms or something. And you know, I don't know that there's anything that I wish that I knew. I guess that I wish I understood how this whole process was going to roll out more. Like learning online, like through your computer, like it seems to work well, at least for my son. Like he seems to do fine. He learns. It's great. there were a couple days where he actually did go into school, like when they were switching up, like, you know, having an option to go in. And his issue was, like, when he went into school, like, the teachers are focusing it on the people online because there's so many people, you know, learning remotely, that the people in the classroom are just sort of sitting there while the teacher stares at the computer, you know, talking that way. So I think, like,
yeah,
you know, that's a problem as well. Like, that's not that's not a great way to learn. That sort of ruins the in-personness of the whole thing.
So, Michael, how do we prepare our parents for the inevitable? So this class and clicks, or, you know, whatever the answer is, how do we prepare them? Because I think a lot of what people think about what's happening in the public school sector of K-12 is sort of like magic. Somebody magically is making all this happen. So, like, in where we are, they give all the kids Chromebooks. They have to get them back by a certain day and all that stuff. But how do we prepare parents for the future of education? What are those things? And I know you spend a lot of time thinking about this. I know this is on your plate, but how do we prepare individuals who are not, you know, not in our business? How do we prepare them for what's coming?
Well, I will say, as a starting point, I do think the pandemic has rapidly accelerated that education. Not universally, but, you know, like all this language that was jargon in our field 2 years ago, synchronous, asynchronous, virtual, remote, you know, that's like very common English language now in large, not all, but large parts of the country. And that's shocking, right? Like blended learning, if I had said that to someone, you know, that's my area, right? And like, but if I had said that to your average person, they would have been like, what? And, or, you know, I talk a lot about how college has gotten too expensive and a lot of them have broken business models and I don't know which ones will survive. Well, like people come up to me now and they're like, what do you think about this college? Is it going to survive? And I'm like, whoa, why is that a question that you asked? Right. But it's sort of popped into the public consciousness. So I do think we've taken some big steps forward along a number of those dimensions. And so the education is somehow percolating and emerging. And I think that's hopeful. I think the second step is that those who are leading it and, you know, superintendents, teachers, the, you know, leaders of colleges and universities, boot camps. I mean, the problem with some of these folks is like, they're the laggards, but those who see where the future is going, I think they need to get out in front of it way more than they are right now. And they need to start talking of not like what it's going to look like, but why it's important and why it can actually benefit all students and why this future, you know, we talk a lot about, for example, mastery-based or competency-based learning, right? That's not a technology phenomenon, but it can be greatly enhanced and accelerated by technology. Don't talk about how grades are going to change and how we won't do A, B, C, D, E, you know, F anymore. Like, instead talk about like why this is great for everyone. We're going to make sure someone masters material, right? Yes, your son and daughter has always been ahead of the class. You know what? Like they can still fulfill their passions and go at their speed, but like, we're not going to be leaving behind anyone else either. Right. So this isn't like you lose out. It's like, we all win. But that, like, we need to be communicating around those possibilities and potentials and the why for them and how you benefit from it. And I don't think we do enough of that. Like we focus, you know, it still happens. Districts like, you know, they move to mastery-based learning and they change the grading system. And the first time the parent hears about it is like, oh my God, they're not getting A through F anymore.
Right.
Well, like you didn't educate them. You didn't bring them along.
Right.
And if you don't do that, yeah, they're going to be, I mean, my mom like threw a fit when she saw it in nearby school. Right. And so, and I was like, this is what I do for a living, mom. Like, you know, so you need to be educating about the why and potential before we think about the how and the what, I think, because then the how and the what, like they'll make those jumps, I think. But sometimes we're putting the cart before the horse.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.